ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world can be a very dangerous place.
The compounds in Myanmar are run by criminal gangs.
American forces snatched Venezuela's president.
You hit us, we'll hit you back again and again.
But behind every conflict is a very interesting story. I'm Matt Bevan, and my show, If You're Listening, takes a look at global stories from the safety of my basement. Find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Albanese government has secured the support of the Greens to pass its capital gains tax and negative gearing changes, but not without some concessions. The legislation will be amended to prevent self-managed super funds borrowing to purchase properties, with the inquiry into the NDIS also extended for 8 weeks until August. Meanwhile, across the pond, the revolving door of prime ministers has continued in the UK, with Sir Keir Starmer announcing his resignation. Sir Keir Starmer's exit was sparked by the by-election and then the election of former Mayor of Manchester Andy Burnham to Parliament, with the so-called King of the North tipped to take the leadership. But it also comes amid the continued rise of right-wing populist party Reform. So, what lessons are there for the Albanese government here at home? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Raf Epstein from The Morning Show on ABC Radio in Melbourne.
Raf, we're going to come to the latest in UK politics because it is so fascinating and I suspect quite a few lessons for Australia out of all of this. It's not like we haven't had our revolving door of prime ministers and we are not dealing with the rise in right-wing populism here. But first, something significant has happened. In fact, I've just run from a freezing press conference in the prime minister's courtyard. I say freezing because I'm frozen and the tip of my nose, it's not a small nose, but the tip is very cold. Where the Prime Minister confirmed what the Greens had already confirmed because they did their press conference first, which is that a deal has been done. The Greens have confirmed they will back Labor's budget tax changes through the Parliament. In fact, it's all going to be done and dusted pretty soon. Katie Gallagher, who's the Finance Minister, said the bells are going to ring at midday. We're going to push this motion. They want this absolutely finished with, this first tranche. In exchange, Labor has agreed to some further carve-outs, although I don't think personally that they're very big or very significant. The Greens have clearly just made a decision to back in this legislation. Self-managed super funds will be prevented from borrowing money to purchase investment properties. The Greens called this a loophole, so they've removed it. Okay, right, so they got that. They also negotiated the removal of broad ministerial powers for the Treasurer of the day. The government said that would happen a couple of days ago, I think. So all of that has happened. But the NDIS changes, and I think this is really significant, Raf, they're kicked down the road. That's a bit trickier for the government. What do you make of the deal? And I'm not at all surprised that the Greens have locked in behind the tax changes. I think they were seeing what was happening in the community and they just thought, let's get this done. What do you think?
Oh, look, the big headline, of course, is that the budget's through, right? Even the changes they announced last week, what's it, $100 million extra a year? And just the fact the changes are going to go through the parliament, that's huge. Maybe we talk later about the fact that I don't think the government's still got a line. Like, they still can't explain why those changes are a good idea. They can if you give them a page, but they can't in one or two neat lines. But to return to the deal, I think it's interesting that the Greens' toughest language was actually reserved for the NDIS, right? The Greens leader, Larissa Waters, she talked about what the government's doing with the NDIS as inhumane, disgusting, and an attack on all of us and on Australian values. So it's clear that the ongoing budget issues and probably the ongoing fight, to be honest, between Greens and Labor is going to be on the NDIS, and it has those budget implications because it hasn't come through yet. But I do think the headline is, like you said, the Greens didn't extract much of a price. That change for self-managed super funds to stop investing, to stop borrow to maintain their investment, I read that's about 1% of all home loans in the country. You're not worried about going up against SMSF investors if you're a first home owner. you're worried about going up against investors as a whole. I think the government's got much bigger political issues to deal with the falling house prices. We know from polls that actually a lot of people like that. But I think getting their lines right on the budget, dealing with One Nation, that's the headline. The NDIS is really significant if you're on it. It's really significant if you know someone who's on it. But as a political thorn in their side, as opposed to a budget issue, I think the government just notches this up as a win, no?
Yeah, it's definitely a win. I mean, getting your legislation through, which they're poised to do on, you know, big taxation changes, obviously a sort of win, because getting your stuff through is kind of fundamental if you're a politician of government and you have to deal with
And also not the pain that the Abbott government went through. You know, if you don't get it through, you have more pain. There's more debate, more platform for debate.
That's right. And it makes it more difficult for its entrenched opponents to keep going, because there's, you know, it's done and dusted in terms of in a legislative sense. Although don't forget, there's another tranche where the trusts and other things are going to come up. So it's not like finished full stop. There is more debate to happen. But on the fundamentals of capital gains tax and negative gearing changes, yeah, it's going to be locked in. So I do think that is significant, but I don't think it's small that the NDIS is going to be kicked down the road. I think that's a big deal, because don't forget, it is the biggest source of savings for the budget and for the government's claim to be, you know, decent economic managers. So right now, they're getting the revenue, right? They're hiking taxes. You might think it's fair, but they're hiking taxes and returning some in a small way to taxpayers through the what they're about to pass. But they're actually, you know, delaying the bit of actually getting money back from its overspend. That's pretty fundamental to budget management. So I reckon that's a big issue. The other issue with an 8-week delay, which is now guaranteed at least, and it could be longer, is think about all of the heartbreaking stories. So we already saw a couple of days of an inquiry with, you know, claims that people would die because of the changes, which is not a small thing to claim. It's pretty alarming. 8 weeks? Think about the horror stories we're going to hear over 8 weeks, Raf. I think broadly the government has support from Australians that it needs to rein in the NDIS, but don't think that that support is static if the Greens to this inquiry and the coalition through their kind of bit of this, bit of that, I don't think they've been entirely consistent on their position on the NDIS, allow for this to gather steam. I think it could become a really big barnacle for the government, the NDIS changes, and really erode support for them in certain areas. I mean, the NDIS is not some small thing. It affects so many people's lives. And so I actually think they do have a pretty big headache looming on the NDIS changes now.
You're right about the potential for pain. I've still got stuck in my mind a woman who called from Dalesford in regional Victoria. Her daughter Gracie's got both profound autism and significant intellectual disabilities. I mention her example because the big thing that Mark Butler wants to cut, they want to slash the social and community participation budget by 50%. Now, what that money allows Gracie to do is it allows her to be a volunteer on Meals for Wheels. Now, that might just sound like a little optional extra, but what Gracie's mum explained when she called in is if Gracie doesn't do that thing, if she's not out there getting that real sort of human value of I'm a volunteer and I'm helping others, if she's at home more and she doesn't have that outlet, her behaviours are then terrible and really tough for her mum to manage. So, yeah, there is real potential for pain. I think that when the Disability Discrimination Commissioner says it's on the government to provide evidence that these changes don't alter the original intent of the scheme, I think we should listen to someone who's in charge of making sure the disability community is not discriminated against. But I still don't think it's major pain. I guess this is me throwing forward a bit to the Britain conversation. It's a much bigger political issue that the federal government, in the middle of one of the biggest realignments in Australian politics in decades, maybe the biggest political alignment since the Second World War. What's Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers' line on why the budget's good? Like, what's their one line? We can go through some of the language. But so you're right. And of course, the NDIS is a massive scheme. It costs a fortune. They've got to prove their budget credibility. We all may need it. It's that sort of scheme as well. But I don't think it's nowhere near being the biggest political problem. And in fact, I think the Greens only being willing to fight them on this and not on their signature issue for many years on housing tells you a lot about where the Greens are. I don't think they are a significant political issue. They are not nearly as significant as what's going on amongst every right-wing party.
Well, if we're going to go to right-wing parties, because you're going there, and I think there's a perfect segue into our Keir Starmer discussion, and that's this. One of the many things that went wrong for Sir Keir Starmer, who, yes, has now stood down, said that he will accepts that he has lost support essentially to be Prime Minister of Britain. Big deal, obviously. But one of the many things that went wrong for him and he ended up blinking on is welfare reform, right?
Yes.
And I think this is a good comparison because here we had a very, very feisty Labor backbench that didn't accept the changes he was making. And admittedly, they were very contentious, you know, ended up blinking on it, I think was one of the many nails in the coffin of his leadership. By comparison, we've got Anthony Albanese, who has proposed these huge NDIS cuts. The bit that they've confirmed is that at least, and it'll be much higher, 160,000 people will be kicked off. Man, that's a big number. That is people in every electorate. Do you hear a peep from the Labor backbench about this? All I can say is if Anthony Albanese remains Prime Minister till the next election, and I'm not suggesting anyone's trying to roll him, but I'm saying if he does, right, which we expect he does, but if, it'll be partly because we've had a very tame, playing nicely Labor backbench, whereas Keir Starmer hasn't had that same kind of support in the UK, which has led to the rise of, you know, Andy Burnham, who's going to clearly become the Prime Minister, as far as I can see. Do you see the point I'm trying to make? Anthony Albanese is able to corral his enormous caucus in a way that Sir Keir Starmer never was. Now, I know that you can't make direct comparisons about everything, but I think that speaks volumes, Raf.
Oh, look, it's a really instructive example. I think I disagree with you on a few elements, but you're right to point
what
to...
What do you disagree with?
I'll get there. The welfare change that you point to is really instructive, and it is one of the big reasons Sir Keir Starmer is not going to be Prime Minister, say, in September. What we're talking about there is a winter fuel payment. Essentially, almost every pensioner gets money for their winter fuel bill. One of the first things that people remember about Keir Starmer's Prime Ministership is he decided to cut it to a much smaller number of pensioners. And here's where I disagree with you. You're right. His backbench were furious about that. A lot of think tanks and sort of economic observers had said that was much too much of a weight on the British budget for a long time, which is why they acted on it. He wanted to prove his fiscal and sort of budget credentials. He backed down on that because his backbench arced up about it. But I actually think the reason Keir Starmer is no longer going to be Prime Minister is people saw that as a lack of conviction. The flip-flopping on that, they took it away from most pensioners. They then gave it back to most, but not all of the pensioners who had it before they got into government. Just the fact that he backtracked on it, that he flip-flopped on it because of pressure from a backbench, which is a lot bigger than Anthony Albanese's. It's 400 MPs as opposed to 90-something MPs. I do think you're right to point to the ability of the backbench in Britain to agitate, be upset with Keir Starmer. That's one of the reasons he's gone. It's very different in some ways. You're right. Anthony Albanese's backbench is resolutely behind him. They're very unwilling to criticise him publicly. And to be honest, they're very unwilling to criticise him privately. I don't know that that's as big an issue as Keir Starmer just changed his mind. The first thing people remember is he tried to establish his budget credentials. And then because his party got upset, he changed his mind. And that's why we're going to be looking at, he's going to be the seventh British Prime Minister in 10 years. Two facts I love about the revolving door of British Prime Ministers. Number one, the British always used to laugh at the Italians. Giorgio Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, has now served for longer as Prime Minister than every British Prime Minister since David Cameron. And Larry the Cat, who I found out this morning, is a rescue cat. I didn't realise Number 10's resident cat was a rescue cat.
So British.
Absolutely. He's the Mouser in Chief, they call him. He has lived at Downing Street longer than any of the Prime Ministers since David Cameron. He's been there for all seven of the Prime Ministers. So It does mean that they get laughed at a lot by everybody else in Europe and by everybody else in around the world. But just to get back to your point, yes, welfare is important, like budget toughness is important, but I actually think the instructive example of Keir Starmer to relate to Anthony Albanese, they're not backing down on the NDIS. They don't have to. I think they've got the Greens over a barrel. There's only so much that the Greens can say and do for so long. The government's got the coalition. You're right to say the coalition want to have their cake and eat it too when it comes to NDIS changes, but they've got their votes. So I do think it's an instructive example, but Albanese's got a much more compliant backbench and he's got much more dominance of the parliament just because of peculiar Australian features of our system.
Yeah, I think all those points are true. And, you know, I think Anthony Albanese would be watching what's unfolding in the UK closely because there are differences, but some similarities. The rise of reform, Nigel Farage's movement, has clearly been one of the hallmarks of why Sir Keir Starmer's prime ministership collapsed as well. A lot of nervous Labor people thinking we are going to be smashed at the next federal election unless, you know, there is a shift and they've moved to this kind of, you know, folksy rock star type of figure who clearly also has so much political experience, having been a minister in Westminster. Like, this is a guy who knows politics. Sir Keir Starmer, always the outsider. And what I mean by that outsider is outside of that kind of, you know, political life and
outside kind of the Westminster village, yeah, they call it.
Yes. That's what I mean by outsider, because really he's a very much an institutionalist human rights lawyer. Like, he's hardly an outsider. He's very much an insider, but a different kind of insider. But I think what's happened in the UK is really demonstrative of, you know, even though Keir Starmer was elected on a platform of stability and we're not going to be a revolving door of prime ministerships, which is essentially what Labor also got elected on, changing its rules. Don't forget, the Labor Party in Australia changed its rules not so it wouldn't get rid of its prime ministers quickly after the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd era. Then the coalition had three prime ministers. And then Labor under Anthony Albanese, with this new kind of difficult leadership model where it was difficult to get rid of a leader, has now presided over, like, he's in his second term, right? Like, we have sort of appeared to have changed things. But in the UK, despite promising to change things, the politics has hit them like a freight train because of the rise of populism and the instability in the system. Now, to think that here we may not see any of that, I think, again, is deluded, right? Like, right now, I am not claiming as I go on this podcast that Anthony Albanese is at all at risk, because I have no evidence of it. But if this One Nation business continues to, you know, basically blaze a very difficult trail for Labor, not just the right-wing parties, as Anthony Albanese says, but for Labor, for working class seats, I think we could see a lot of turmoil in terms of questions about the future of the Labor Party here, the way it's governed. I reckon, watch that space, Raf. I think it'll be determined by what happens in the next 6 months. You say the tax stuff's now being neutralised because it will pass the parliament, but the NDIS stuff could keep looming as a problem. The tax stuff may pass, but that doesn't mean it's done and dusted in terms, yes, of a political debate in the community. I think many people are not sold on Labor's changes. Labor hasn't done the other side of this, which is you're going to get a dividend, your living standards will increase. We know partly why they haven't. They were going to do it later, closer to the next election. There's an inflation crisis. But I reckon all of that is a big looming problem for them. I really do. I'm utterly convinced of it. Do you disagree? You're the one that talks to the real people. I'm here talking to only the fake people, you know, the Canberra bubble. That's my world.
I think you and I both talk to both.
I know, I take the piss.
But let's put one of Anthony Albanese's lines from today in the context of what's happening in Britain. Okay, let me see if I can stretch our brains that far. So I keep I keep pointing out they just need to have a better explanation of why they've done this change to capital gains tax. There's this painful line from the PM today. These tax reforms will give better alignment for income earned from work with income earned from assets and wealth. I think I know what that means, but it has zero cut through. That's a problem for the Prime Minister. The other really important parallel with Britain and Australia, Anthony Albanese won 34.5% of first preference votes and got a stonking majority. Keir Starmer won just under that, 33.7, right? Albo was 34.5. Keir Starmer won 33.7% of the vote, got a stonking majority. Now, they're fundamentally different electoral systems because they're not compulsory. They don't have compulsory voting over there and they don't have preferential. But you essentially had a few years ago an ascendant Labour Party, and now Keir Starmer has gone and the Labour Party is terrified of the populist right. There's no doubt, and you know this from speaking to people inside the government, they're worried about the populist right here. What's really interesting and what's instructive, they got there earlier, right? Britain had this populist surge earlier. This week is 10 years since the Brexit referendum went through. That's really the beginning of the surge of the populist right in Britain. What's really amazing about Andy Burnham is this is someone who's never really nailed his political colours to the mast. He doesn't really have a fixed ideology. Reform have led in, I think it's something like 300 polls.
Yeah.
Like 300 polls. But he still won. And he won a majority of votes. He didn't win a, you know, he didn't win a plurality. He didn't just win the biggest number of votes. He won a majority of votes in a country where Reform has led by double digits. So they get something like 30%. Labour gets something like 20%. They've done that 300 times. Andy Burnham still won. And he won in an electorate that's older, wider, and less educated. And I actually think the lesson that I hear from Labour politicians here is it makes a difference. Your brand, your ability to connect to voters, that horrible word, authenticity,
yeah.
But it's fantastically useful. And I think the other instructive thing about Andy Burnham, I criticise him as an insider for failing to nail his colours to the mast. The terrible joke that is told about him again and again and again and again and again is that a Blairite, a Brownite and a Starmerite walk into a bar and the barman says, what will you be having, Andy? The implication being there is that he'll be a Blairite one day, a Brownite the next day, and then he'll back here, Starmer. He even lied about whether or not he'd stick around as the Mayor of Greater Manchester for his third term. He's in the middle of his third term and he said repeatedly, because he was asked when he won the third term, will you stay? Will you stick around for the whole 4 years? He's 2 years in, he's gone. So actually that the ability to be both pliable, change your mind, and not suffer a cost because of that, he is the example supreme of what parties like the Australian Labor Party need to do. I think it's an instructive example, to be very Victorian parochial, for the dilemma the Victorian state Labor government is in. It makes a difference who's leading the party. Mm-hmm. These forces amongst the populist right, they're tectonic. But yes, the tax changes and the NDIS, any one of those things can become the issue that totally changes people's perception of Labor. And when we are in this phenomenon where One Nation's getting 20-something percent, so's Labor getting 20-something percent, and the Coalition's getting 20-something percent, the Labor Party, the Treasurer and the PM often talk about the three-ring circus, which is their way of describing the Liberal Party, the National Party and One Nation. But we've
The three right-wing parties.
Well, that's their derisive name, right? Mm. The three-ring circus. But we've got three major parties. We don't know where this is going to land. But Burnham's example is really instructive. And Reform don't even have many MPs. They've got something like 8 MPs in the House of Commons. And they've now got a challenge from to the right of them, the Restore Party with the similar name. Burnham is the counter example. He's basically going counter to all of the political gravity in Europe that appears to be favouring, like a tide, favouring all of those right-wing populist parties. But if you talk enough about the buses in Manchester that are cheaper and now government-owned, and you have a really good just personal brand, there he is. You know, he took the train to London overnight, Australian time, Monday into Tuesday, just a T-shirt. He's just like all the other dads taking their kids to the football. He took a train from Manchester to London. But those things count. And I actually think that's another reason why our Prime Minister is going to keep on popping up on FM radio shows. He's going to be chatting to Husey and Binksy and PKZ and Rafsy and whoever he can chat to. I don't know. I mean, I don't even know their names. Yeah. But it's really important. That's part of his brand. I'm not saying he's as good at it as Andy Burnham, but it is one of the electoral assets that you have. What do you think, people in the federal Labor government, what do they see in Andy Burnham? What do you reckon their lessons are from Andy Burnham?
Well, I don't know. I can't give you an educated answer on that, on how they've worked it out, because I haven't asked enough questions, right? And I try to be informed about my answers. But I think they'd be watching it pretty closely, being, you know, a pretty similar democracy to ours. Obviously, ours is a derivative of it. And, you know, cultural similarities. I'm not saying the UK doesn't have big differences too, but this is, you know, this is kind of like it's the Labour Party's sister party too. Like it's, there's a lot of similarities, and watching this unfold, I think, is a moment for Labour here as well to sort of go, oh, okay, like shit's getting real over there. You know what I mean? Like things can really turn, and how to manage that. Now, the rise of the right here obviously is not identical, because Pauline Hanson really, you know, to give her some credit, she was doing this stuff before Nigel Farage and Donald Trump. And I think, you know, she's a trailblazer on the right of politics in many ways. She is. It's a fact, right? But she said a lot of things that she's been having to mop up today. And I think that tells you a lot about where she's positioning and how they... And the advice she's getting, it's instructive. She must be hearing that some of the things she's saying are going a little too far, like, for instance, paid parental leave. So she today was on Sunrise. We're recording this on a Tuesday. She kind of walked back some of her parental leave comments because I think there is a sting. It's become very normalised. I think there is a broad acceptance, not of course universal, but a broad acceptance that women who have to leave the workforce to give birth because of biology to the children that we have collectively, like you've got kids, but your wife had to have them.
The decisions are collective.
Yeah, like you wanted to have them. You love your sons. You wanted them, but you can't give birth to them. So, you know.
Basic biology with Patricia 101.
Yeah, come to me for some home truths, right? Mm. And I don't think the sympathy for, you know, modern young women on this line of, well, I did it on my own. I think women roll their eyes at that. They think that was bad, but that doesn't mean we all have to suffer just because you had to do it that way, which was her line. Now she says she worries that business is paying for it. The government should. Well, the government does pay for it, Pauline Hanson. There is a Commonwealth-funded paid parental leave scheme. Also, business bolsters it. But the fact, if I can go to the actual substance, like the political positioning here, that she's walked it back a bit, Raf, isn't that an indication that some of the stuff they're saying sticks on the wall, but other stuff doesn't, and they have to kind of neutralise it a little? That's the evidence I see.
Oh, I think you're right. They definitely have to neutralise it. It's a little bit like that terrible COVID metaphor. One nation's building the plane while flying it. I think it's fascinating that Pauline Hanson had to, she felt the need to walk back the parental leave stuff. They are so much more professional. She's not just, back in the 90s, she sort of shopped out a lot of her policy to some pretty wild right-wing extremist fringe groups, like the sort of the 2% tax. You pay 2% every time you make a payment, which is sort of a very loopy, crazy idea that's very impractical. She used to farm that policy out to those sort of fringe groups. She's not anymore. The rumours about having significant people from Donald Trump's social media campaign on her team, the fact she's got Australia's richest person, Gina Rinehart, I think they've really professionalised. They are trying to rub the edges off some of the nastier things that One Nation has said. I actually spoke earlier in the week to Colleen Harkin. She's a significant person in the administrative part of the Liberal Party here in Victoria. She's jumping ship to One Nation. She's clearly going to be a big part of the effort. When I really pushed her on some of the very toxic things that Pauline Hanson says about Islam, one of the things Colleen Harkin said to me is, oh, look, I'm not going to go through statement by statement, you know, the things that Pauline Hanson says. I think they're very aware, both Pauline Hanson and everyone beneath her, they know it's their moment. They know they are surfing that wave, but they're more professional. And I think the people who are listened to, that Pauline Hanson does listen to, are saying to her, all of this stuff on parental leave, backtrack on that. I don't think she'll backtrack on workers are lazy, more worried about small business than the conditions that workers might face if they are sacked. I don't think she'll backtrack on that. But they're trying to rub the hard edges off because they know this is their moment. Do you think, PK, the federal government's attacks are working? Like, do you think they are worried by that? Because I noticed even some of the rhetoric from the Treasurer, especially in the Parliament yesterday in question time, you know, they don't vote for workers, you know, they don't support workers, we do. Do you think One Nation is at all aware or concerned of the federal government's attacks, especially around workers?
Yeah, based on the sort of rhetoric they're using and some of the walking back, yeah, I think there is clearly they're really alive to it. Yep, absolutely. I reckon that's definitely the case. And I think the positioning of different politicians around One Nation at the moment is really interesting. Yesterday I interviewed John O'Dunningham, who's a right-wing politician from the Liberal Party, a senator, Shadow Home Affairs Minister, Andrew Hastie's best mate, like a really, you know, kind of significant Liberal, really, one of the most talented people, I think, on the Liberal front bench, who said he was going to leave the Parliament, had enough, and he'll be gone by the end of the year. Now, I asked him about One Nation, and he said he thinks they're a bigger risk than Labor, because with Labor, you know what they stand for.
Big statement.
And I, huge, especially, that's why I gave the description of who he is. He is on the right side. He does want to go harder on some cultural issues. He's been clear about that in the past. And yet, on this, he makes that comment. I reckon there's an interesting alignment. As One Nation has pushed further on some issues, including that monoculture line, where the Prime Minister commented on that again today at his press conference, I've found it really fascinating to see the Liberals, even right-wing Liberals, not back that in, but start celebrating multiculturalism. So in a weird way, Pauline Hanson, instead of the, you know, that kind of, oh, Pauline Hanson's making the Liberal Party One Nation light, I'm going to say something very controversial that I bet lots of people will disagree with, but just hear me out. I think she's made some right-wing Liberals, including people like Garth Hamilton, again, sort of a more sort of populist right-wing figure in the Liberal Party. They've been defending multiculturalism all week. They've been saying that, you know, this is kind of a top-heavy, you know, we all have to be the same anti-pluralistic version of Australia and we were never this. What it doesn't even mean to be monocultural. And I'm like, wow, Pauline Hanson is uniting the mainstream parties to embrace multiculturalism again. And I think that's kind of interesting, don't you?
I think it's really interesting. It calls back the Liberal Party of Petro Georgiou, the Liberal Party that basically is the reason we've got the Special Broadcasting Service, SBS. The other thing that I think is interesting, you're talking there really about the mainstream ganging up on One Nation or saying, actually, no, that's a line we're not prepared to cross. That's also what happened in the Makerfield by-election that elected Andy Burnham. The Lib Dems, maybe this is a longbow, maybe it isn't. The Lib Dems did fantastically well at the last general election. They had only votes in the double figures in that by-election in Makerfield because the Lib Dems went to another party, all the Conservative voters went to another party, like Labor, to stop reform. So this is a phenomenon that we've seen in France as well. There's a reason the resurgent populist right in France, they've been strong for a long time. They never win a presidential election because people who might be bitterly divided if they're centre-right versus centre-left, they will gang up on what they call the far right. So I think it's another way in which we are becoming more like Europe, more like Britain. This week in Australia, it's about monocultural versus multicultural. But the other thing maybe to bring into this, the new poll from the Lowy Institute, and this maybe goes to some of the things Pauline Hanson hasn't been asked about. They run this poll every year. Not only are Australians at a record low when it comes to our esteem for the United States, 31% of Australians believe America would act responsibly, like 31%. A few years ago, it was at 65%. So there's a really diminished view of the US amongst Australians. But only 21% of Australians say they'd trust Donald Trump to do the right thing in world affairs. And according to Lowy, that's the lowest level of confidence in any US president in the history of the poll. We know Trump's on the nose. Trump was on the nose in the Australian election last year. Pauline Hanson, and it's really worth going back, have a listen to Paul Sakal's interview on the Nine Papers podcast. She wouldn't say anything bad about Donald Trump, not even the fact that her supposed key constituents, farmers, in April this year, they were paying double for fertilizer. It doubled because of the war that Donald Trump chose to pursue. So much of the economic volatility we've got, the rise in rates, the rise in inflation, that is because of a war of choice from Donald Trump. Pauline Hanson hasn't been asked about that. She hasn't been pressed on that. So we're beginning to see, I guess, the dimensions of where does her support extend to? Where is it limited? You know, what ceilings and walls might it face?
Yeah, I think that big question around her inability to critique Trump at all when he's actually politically toxic in Australia is going to be one of the problems for her. I don't know if it's one of the reasons people are turning to One Nation is just, you know, like the burn down the system. We're so angry, you know.
They're angry at us and they're angry at the major parties. They're angry at everyone except
Pauline.
Yeah,
they're annoyed. And, you know, I get why people are annoyed. I mean, there's good reasons to be annoyed. It's about how you use that annoyance to sort of make things better for everyone. That's the big question. But, like, it is playing out in mysterious ways that are very unpredictable, I think, because the world is unpredictable. That's it for Politics Now today. Raf, love talking to you. Feel like it's very therapeutic. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure and a privilege to have a chat to you and to be on the pod.
And tomorrow I'll be joined by Claire Armstrong. If you have a question for us, send it to theparty@abc.net.au and we will answer it in our Question Time edition. See you, Raf.
See you later.